Hello and welcome. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome everyone here to just this three CMEO snacks titled The Impact of Vaccine Hesitancy and Under-Vaccination in Pediatric Patients. The CMEO snack series is supported by an educational grant from Merck Sharp and Dohme LLC, a subsidiary of Merck and Company Incorporated. My name is Gloria E. Barrera. I am a full-time public health nurse. I work at a high school outside of Chicago and also a visiting clinical instructor at UIC. I'm joined today by my distinguished colleague, Dr. Kathy Baldridge.
Hi there. So
Hi,
welcome,
Kathy.
she said. Just a little bit about me. I am a family nurse practitioner in Pineville, Louisiana, so right in the middle of the state. I have been a family nurse practitioner now for almost 15 years and a nurse for over 30 years. So been around the block a few times. I am an author and editor and invited speaker, and my full-time job is teaching review courses to nurse practitioner students that are preparing to take for their certification exam. So Advanced Practice Education Associates is who I work for full time. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Just really to frame the discussion today, I wanted to start with reviewing our learning objective. So it is to identify the impact of vaccine hesitancy as part of under vaccination in the pediatric population. So our goal really is that after this CME snack, you will be able to identify the impact of vaccine hesitancy as part of that under vaccination in the pediatric population. So you may have already heard of the term vaccine hesitancy, but what exactly is vaccine hesitancy? Dr. Baldridge, could you tell us just a little bit more about what you're seeing on in your practice for vaccine hesitancy?
Sure. So, we've seen a lot of that really rise to the surface during the last 4 years with the onset of COVID. And so, just to let you know what the umbrella term vaccine hesitancy means, it means really a delay in an acceptance or refusal of a vaccine that is available. And so, I want to clarify that because there are some people that, because of access to care issues, they may not be available to them. And so that is not hesitancy because it's not available. So when it is available, but a person refuses or delays accepting that vaccine, that is what the term vaccine hesitancy refers to. And it's really a complicated issue. You cannot pinpoint just one thing that contributes to that hesitancy or refusal. It's different for different people, different societies, different cultures. It may be political influences that impact that as well. So there's just many, many different reasons that a person may delay acceptance or refuse a vaccine.
Thank you. So we just reviewed, what the vaccine hesitancy is, the term. But let's now just look at what the root causes of vaccine hesitancy, what they are. The 5 C's model, as we know it, explains some of these contributing factors, really well. And Dr. Baldridge, could you just discuss these, with us?
Sure. So originally, there were only 3 C's. And so those were complacency. And that's really where people just think, you know what? I'm healthy. I'm healthy. I have a great immune system. There is no reason for me to get this vaccine because it's really not going to impact me. And so they really just kind of have that belief that, I don't need the vaccine because I'm good. And then there was convenience. And so that is where, again, access to care. Maybe they don't have access to the vaccines in their community. And we've seen a lot of that being addressed at the political level. So at the federal level and at states level, and where bills are passed. And so we know now that a lot of vaccines are available through pharmacies. So, you're going to have a pharmacy in the community. You may not have a primary care provider necessarily, but there will be a pharmacy there. So we've seen some issues like that that have tried to really do away with that, it is more convenient for people to get the vaccines. And constraints may be another one too, and that's some structural and psychological barriers. years, that kind of really under convenience. And then confidence. We saw a lot of that during COVID resurface. People just don't have confidence in the science or what's being put out there. And, you know, they hear one thing from one place and one thing from another place. And social media has been a really big influence on people's confidence levels in vaccines. So those were the three original C's. And then they've also added in collective responsibility. And so that's people's idea that, oh, I have to get vaccinated because I have a grandmother who is getting chemotherapy. And so I want to be protected, you know, and some people don't necessarily have that sense of collective responsibility. So that may contribute to the hesitancy. And then calculation, that is gathering information, understanding the information that is out there. And sometimes, even for medical professionals, understanding some of that information is a challenge. So those are the things that really have been deemed to be the contributing factors to vaccine hesitancy.
As we, you know, all know, the ACIP recommends that all children get different vaccines at different ages. And I just want to speak really briefly about what I'm seeing here in Illinois, for example, of students that are on the immunization schedule for school. You know, children get numerous vaccines throughout their childhood, but there are states that mandate them for schools. And we can see that there are some trends as we look at, you know, over the years of how many children are getting vaccinated. And I kind of want to focus on that. Could you just speak to what we've been seeing in you know, just right now, the data of how many children are getting vaccinated, and you know, what's the relation maybe to those that are in states that mandate vaccines for entry into schools, like here in Illinois, and you know, where you're at.
Yeah, there are some trends, and you know, there's a great graphic that's on the screen for you. And so I encourage you to look at that. And really what jumps out to me is what we don't see is an upward trend. It's either plateaued or there's a downward trend. And so that is concerning because we really do need vaccines. And you know, I think that the reason, one of the reasons that we see just that plateau or even a downward trend is the further we get away from some of these diseases that have been completely eradicated, people don't remember. They don't remember what devastation some of these diseases had on, you know, populations. One of my husband tells me I'm kind of morbid, but one of the things that I love to do when we visit certain places is find the oldest cemetery there and walk through. And I know it does kind of seem more what I'm looking for. Sometimes you will see whole families that were wiped out within a week of each other. That was a pandemic. That was a pandemic that went through, usually, you know, and so that's the things that I'm looking at. And it's just staggering when you think about some of those things. And so we don't see an increase in vaccination rates, you know, when you look at the DTaP. When you look at MMRs, those are pretty steady. And when you look at the seven vaccine series, there's a decline there. It's just concerning when you see that there's not an increase in vaccination rates.
And I know you touched on this already, but looking at those states that mandate vaccines for entry into school, for example, in Illinois, and I can share just what I'm seeing, you know, on the front lines as a public health nurse specialized in school nursing. I know that school nursing play, you know, they play a really important role in making sure that our students are safe and healthy and ready to learn. And a lot of our work is with immunization compliance. And you know, with the Illinois State Board of Education and Illinois Department of Public Health, we really do track and report yearly on our vaccination rates. And like you said, Dr. Baldridge, there is an upward trend. But we can always be doing better. So, that's why we're here. And you know, we have looked at the current vaccination rates in the US. But what happens when these trends, you know, drop? There are some concerning consequences, associated delays with, and of course, refusals to vaccinate that we'll sort of touch on. So Dr. Baldridge, can you just discuss these with us?
Sure. And we see some of that. So Louisiana is not one of those states that have mandated vaccines for entry into school. They can always opt out. There's a, you know, a form that they can fill out to do that. But here's what we see when they don't vaccinate. We see that, you know, they're are at increased risk for getting one of these preventable diseases. And so one of when I did my thesis in lieu of paper in my master's program, one of the things that I did was on the influenza vaccine because that particular year we had about 15 students in Rapides Parish Schools, which is where I'm at. You know, Louisiana, we don't do counties, it's parishes. And so those children fell between the ages of 11 and 16, and they all died from the flu that year. And, you know, 15 doesn't sound like a huge number, but for every one of those families, that was a 100% probability that it happened, and they were not vaccinated. And so that was, I wanted to know more about that. And so I really dug into it and I followed it through the years because that is a preventable, and people just have misconceptions about the flu vaccine. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. But because of that, we see increased hospitalizations, we see increased deaths, we see increased costs to the healthcare system, increased costs to families, obviously, because it's not a cost as in a financial cost, but it certainly costs that family. There's negative impact on community protection thresholds, so herd immunity, because we have to reach certain thresholds of vaccination in order for there to be herd immunity to protect some of those people who may not be able to take the vaccine. So maybe they have a severe allergy and they're not able to take it. And so herd immunity is a real thing and a real important thing for the community. You know, and if they are very hesitant to begin with and decide not to take the vaccine, and then later on decide to, then that catch-up schedule, because we have those catch-up schedules, then there's, you know, increased stakes related to that. It's just such an issue when there's hesitancy and refusal to vaccinate on multiple different levels, on the personal level, the family unit, the community, the hospital system, healthcare workers. It's just really an impact.
Yeah, and I think this would be a good time just to share the position of the National Association of School Nurses on just how important immunizations are. They're, you know, essential to primary prevention of disease from, you know, infancy through adulthood. And really childhood vaccinations are an effective way of preventing serious childhood illnesses. And we are NASN are in support of the elimination of all exemptions, except through through those that are necessary for valid medical contraindications. So I know that you mentioned that there's an exemption, you know, exemptions form in your state, but I just wanted to make sure that I pointed that out, that the National Association of School Nurses really is against those exemptions. We are, you know, starting to see trends in recent years regarding drops in immunization of children, but I want to just quickly shift gears to outbreaks. You know, what are we seeing that are significant consequences because of decreased vaccination rates? And obviously we can point to the recent outbreaks, and I just wanted to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, yeah, and I'll start with the flu since I already kind of started there before. But we do see decreased numbers, especially in the pediatric population, of being immunized against the flu. And I think some of that is just misconceptions. And I hear people say it all the time. They're like, well, you know, I'm just, they missed it. They missed it the last few years. They didn't get the right strain And so, we still had a bunch of flus. Well, we may have had a bunch of flu cases where people were diagnosed with the flu, but how many deaths did we have? And so sometimes they just don't understand the science behind the influenza vaccine. And so they don't necessarily choose the one that is going to be the most prevalent. They choose the ones to include that are going to have the highest rates of morbidity and mortality. And so they didn't miss it. So you may still have a bunch, but I think explaining that and helping people to understand that even though you are normally healthy, the flu can really, if it's one of those strains that has increased morbidity and mortality, that can happen to normally healthy people. And so explaining that is important. But then you look at things like measles. Measles, we didn't hear a lot about for years and years that there were cases of measles almost completely eradicated. But we're seeing measles outbreaks resurface. There was one recently in New Orleans, an outbreak, and the outbreaks are happening amongst people who are unvaccinated, happening in communities where there's high levels of, people that are not vaccinated. And so it's impacting the community as well. Pertussis, we didn't hear about for a long time. And, people have the perception that, well, it's only in children. Well, it's not. It's in adults too. Adults don't typically have high rates of mortality related to pertussis, but children do, and children can catch it from adults. And so just explaining and understanding some of that, and the only vaccine, the only vaccine preventable disease that we haven't seen resurface is smallpox at this point. But we have seen others resurface, polio. There's even been some outbreaks of polio. And we also have to remember that, with travel increasing, that there's other countries that don't necessarily have the same requirements that we have for vaccinations or even have availability sometimes of those vaccinations. But people are traveling and moving around. And so vaccines just help protect you against getting some of those vaccine preventable illnesses.
Yeah, I know that you mentioned the measles outbreak in New Orleans, and I did want to also touch on what we saw here in Chicago, and that was just, this past March, with the increase in measles cases among young children at the, Halsted Street shelter in Pilsen. And those were the newly new arrivals in the migrant shelter, and they should have received a second dose of the measles vaccines, the 28 days later after the first dose, and they did not. So I think making sure that we have policies in place to protect our most vulnerable populations, and those include people that are in the migrant shelters. So thank you for mentioning that. What do we know about the impact of measles on patients, aside from the outbreak, just the impact of it?
Yeah, so measles is one of the most highly contagious diseases. If there's one person that is infected and they're just breathing into the air, it can impact 10 other people that are around them. So very, very contagious disease process. And again, but I think because we've gotten so far removed from when we had a lot of cases of measles, we tend to forget the complications. It is not a benign disease process, and it can result in very serious complications. I mean, people can have meningitis, and they get meningitis related to that, the mortality rates increase. They can have an encephalitis. They can have, lots of pneumonia. And anytime they get a secondary infection related to one of these diseases, then the mortality rates increase. It's just not that easy to overcome. And one of the things that we know about measles is it really does attack your immune system, and it makes your immune system very vulnerable to other conditions that may happen. And so, again, some of the millennials and even the Gen Zs, are not that familiar with measles because it was almost completely eradicated. And so it is not a benign disease. I want to say that again. There are very serious complications that can occur if you get measles, and it is so highly contagious that it spreads very easily. So that's why you have to have, in order to for herd immunity to happen, you have to have higher rates of vaccination rates amongst people in order to provide a level of herd immunity, just because it is so viral. It is so easily spread.
Yeah, and I think this would be a good time to also just look at the policy. So for example, in Pilsen, where there were the measles cases, the measles outbreak, in response to that, the policy from the state of Illinois, it's going to now require those two doses of the MMR vaccine for K through 12 school attendance. And it's going to be extended even into children who are 5 years of age and younger. And then also the shelter residents under 12 months who are not yet vaccinated would be then excluded from daycare or, any kind of early learning until 21 days after their last measles exposure. So just having those in place is really important when we do see this, if it happens in other areas across the country. I know that you mentioned pertussis, so I did want to touch on that as well. So pertussis, otherwise known as, whooping cough, has been associated with outbreaks, as you mentioned. And what do we know already about, the whooping cough?
Well, we have had some serious outbreaks there too. In 2012, that was the most recent peak year of whooping cough. There were a little over 48,000 cases that were reported in the US. Between 2014 and 2019, almost 120,000 cases were reported by the CDC. And according to the CDC as well, about 20 babies a year will die from the whooping cough. And again, that doesn't sound statistically significant, but for the families that lose their infants, it is statistically significant, especially when you think about this is a disease that did not have to result in mortality, because we do have a vaccine that is very efficacious to help with that. It was, gosh, probably about 15 years ago that they recommended the Tdap, that all adults get a booster with the Tdap, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. So they added that all together because they did recognize that it was so very important for the caregivers of those babies to be protected against pertussis so that you didn't transmit that disease to the infants who were not yet able to be protected against it. So that's very important. And I do want to drive home the point too that yes, we do think of it as whooping cough. And if you ever hear that cough, you will never ever forget it because it is so impactful. But not all babies have a cough. And the prodrome of pertussis is they may just have an upper respiratory infection. So you may not even recognize. They just have a runny nose. They may not even have a cough. And then it turns into pertussis, and they may develop that whooping type cough, but they may not. They may just turn blue and stop breathing. And so, what a scary event for a parent to have to go through. And if they're not vaccinated, again, mortality rates increase. And so, it's just very important that people understand why herd immunity is important, why it's important to be vaccinated for the babies when they do get to the age where it's time for them to be vaccinated, and for the adults that are caring for them until the time that they can receive the pertussis vaccine to reduce the risk of morbidity and mortality related to that.
Looking at just the next slide with HPV, and again, looking at it from a school nursing lens, I know that school nurses really do play a critical role in protecting, the next generation from cancers caused by HPV. And we really are making strong recommendations, but also incorporating that evidence-based, practice, the strategies to increase the HPV vaccine uptake, such as providing families and students with reminders and, on specific talks about the HPV and the series. But what is the impact of HPV on patients who don't get vaccinated?
So they are at risk for developing an HPV-related cancer. If it's females, then cervical cancer is at the top of the list. But there are other cancers that can be related to HPV as well. We're seeing an increase in esophageal cancers, especially in males, but it can also happen in females. And then you can have an HPV-related anal cancer as well if you're a participant in anal intercourse. And so it's not just cervical cancer that we think about, and it does impact males and females, and those cancers are on the rise. We also know that there's genital warts that are related to HPV, and obviously that is not a quantity of life issue. It's not an issue that you're necessarily going to have increased mortality rates from, but it is a quality of life issue. If you've ever treated someone that has genital warts, it very much impacts every aspect of their life. And so those are some of the most common HPV-related diseases. And HPV is ubiquitous. Do you know what that means? That means that everyone that has had sexual intercourse, unless you were a true virgin and your partner was a true virgin, then everyone is exposed to HPV. So that's what ubiquitous means. It is just a rampant sexually transmitted infection. And we have a very efficacious vaccine for that. When you look at, that's one of the things that excites me so much. When I see some of the studies that are coming out about the impact of the HPV vaccine, this vaccine came out in 2006 or 2009, always, I can't remember which one it is, but around that time. And so now we're starting to see some of the longitudinal data that's really coming out of that. And it is exciting when you look at those percentages of how much reduction that we're seeing in cervical-related cancers, in genital warts. It is just really, really exciting to me to see the efficacy of that vaccine and the impact that it's had on the people that have taken the vaccine. So very encouraging data.
So what has been the impact of the HPV vaccine? What are some of the issues that we have seen already with vaccination? I'm just wondering if there's been a trend in HPV vaccination and obviously the contributing to the lag in male vaccination. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. And I really do feel like there's been more of an uptake in the females who have taken the vaccine than it has the males. And I think a lot of that is really just misunderstanding because we do hear a lot about cervical cancer and that cervical cancer is related to HPV. And you see commercials about it and information about it that's everywhere. But we haven't done a really good job of helping people to understand why it's important to vaccinate males as well. It is a sexually transmitted infection. So if the males are vaccinated, then it does provide some protection to the females too, so that they don't get cervical cancer. But again, there are male-related cancers that are HPV, including genital warts. And so there can be an esophageal cancer, there can be an anal cancer, there can be the genital warts, like we talked about. So there are cancer impacts for males as well. And again, let me take you back to that herd immunity. And one of the studies, I think that came out of Switzerland, they did have a high rate of females and they did have a mandate for females to get the HPV vaccine. And what they saw was that there was some herd immunity that was provided to males because there was such a high rate of females that were vaccinated. But we do encourage and we need to do a better job of encouraging males to be vaccinated and the understanding of why it's important for them to be vaccinated as well. And when we do, oh my gosh, those percentages are going to increase even more. So it's just really exciting.
So we have discussed a lot today about the impact that vaccination has on children across the US and the consequences of under vaccination. But how can we as nurses really improve the immunization uptake in children and have better conversations with parents, with families? That's what we're going to talk about. And I think, again, looking at it from a school nursing lens, NASN supports ACIP vaccination recommendations as adopted by the CDC and, states and local vaccine mandates. We're highly in favor of that. But we also use the support of the school nurse in accessing state registries, an important practice tool, but also using state registries to facilitate immunization compliance. For example, here in Illinois, there's IVAC, ICARE, and we use that to identify, immunization status of students in the event of disease outbreaks, and also the prevention of duplication of vaccinations when records have been lost, destroyed, or otherwise misplaced. And just to that end, school nurses really are strongly positioned within the communities that we serve to educate students, families, and school staff about the critical role that vaccines play in preventing diseases. And again, that's always to allow students to remain in school healthy and ready to learn. But what else? What else can we do to improve vaccination?
Well, I think education is always important. And as providers, as nurses, whatever your role is within the healthcare system, I think being well educated about vaccines and about the immune system is probably one of the most important things. Because if you're not well educated, then how can you educate someone else? And, we touched on everything when we went through nursing school. And, but sometimes if you don't delve in it and live in it every day, you kind of forget how the immune system works, maybe in its entirety, or maybe how long a vaccine has been out, even, and that this isn't new science. And so I spend a lot of time educating. I've immunization updates at several state conferences and national conferences because I do feel like it's an important reminder of where the vaccines have come from, the science behind them. And as providers, we really need to understand that so that we can help communicate that to our patients and the community at large. And so I think that is a very important place for us to start, is digging into the science. And then when they hear, a certain thing on social media or a certain thing from the news media, we want them to bring that to us. We want them to have that trust relationship with us that they come and say, "Hey, I heard this. What do you think about that?" And we want to be able to deliver them the facts, not my personal opinion, not my culture, not my religious views, but what the science says. And that's what we need to be able to communicate to our patients. And so, as a provider, whether it's vaccines or anything else, that's what I do all day, every day. I inform them, these are your choices. Here's the risk, here's the benefits. And that's how you build trust relationships. They obviously are in charge of their healthcare. I'm not in charge of their healthcare. They are, but they need to make informed decisions. And the information has to be reliable and valid information. And it's our job to do that to them, for them. And when we do, you are building that trust relationship with them. And I think the other probably most important part is maybe where it fell under support for you is motivational interviewing. So motivational interviewing is understanding where that patient is coming from or what their views are and supporting them in that by giving them education, by providing information to them. But, it's their decision to make. They just have to have all of the information from a trusted source to make the best informed decision that they can for them and their families.
Yeah, and what better way than by nurses. You know, we've been voted as the most trusted profession by the Gallup poll for a number of years now. So let's just summarize with our SMART goals, and that is to be specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and of course, timely. We hope that our audience will take away from this presentation is the following. So it's to identify the components of vaccine hesitancy that negatively impact vaccination rates, recognize the trends of childhood vaccination and the consequences behind decreasing rates of immunization in the U.S., and then positively affect childhood vaccination rates via effective communication to parents of the impact of delayed vaccination and declined vaccination on children. Just the last two slides here, these activities and a wide variety of activities and resources on vaccinations are available on the CME Outfitters Virtual Education Hub for both healthcare providers and patients alike. This CMEO snack is one of a three-part series, as we mentioned at the beginning. We hope that you'll take advantage of all of the short and focused activities in the series. And to receive a CME and CE credit for today's program, please complete the post-test and evaluation, and you'll be able to download and print then your certificate immediately upon completion. Thank you again to Dr. Baldridge for joining me today, and thank you to our audience for participating and providing the best care for patients. We'll see you in the next one. Thank you.